W233AH Monticello.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, all eyes were on Pennsylvania Tuesday as the key swing state held pivotal elections that could send a clear message for November's race for the White House. We'll get the results from VoteBeat PA and Spotlight PA, including the special election in Pennsylvania's 139th district, which covers Wayne and Pike counties. Delaware Highlands Conservancy is celebrating 30 years. We'll learn about their celebratory dinner coming up May 4th. And the Outrage is an environment for craft exploration, providing a safe space for risk-taking and imagination for queer writers. Playwright and performer C. Julian Jimenez joins us to talk about their work that they're sharing after their residency Friday at NACL in Highland Lake. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. The U.S. Supreme Court is set to hear a case today that will test whether a state can ban medical termination of a pregnancy if a woman's health but not her life is in grave danger. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
After the Supreme Court reversed Roe v. Wade, Idaho and a handful of other states enacted laws that ban all abortions except to save the life of the mother. The Biden administration contends those laws conflict with a federal law passed in 1986 called the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act and known as EMTALA. It requires that hospitals receiving Medicare and Medicaid payments from the federal government, that they must provide at least stabilizing care for any patient whose life or health is in serious jeopardy. And in some cases, that would include a medical abortion. The only alternative under the Idaho law would be to transport the patient out of state. But the state contends that EMTALA does not provide a national baseline of care, and thus that the state is free to ban abortions except to save the life of the mother. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Today, Democratic lawmakers in Arizona will try to repeal the state's Civil War-era abortion ban. Arizona's Supreme Court upheld the near-total ban earlier this month. It could take effect in June. Governor Katie Hobbs and Arizona's Attorney General have said they won't enforce it. House Speaker Mike Johnson is scheduled to visit Columbia University in New York today amid ongoing protests over the war between Israel and Hamas. NPR's Giles Snyder reports.
Johnson may be the highest-ranking member of Congress to visit Columbia since the protests began, but he's not the first. At least two congressional delegations were at the school on Monday, and New York House Republicans are calling on Columbia's president to step down. Johnson's office says he will meet with Jewish students amid concerns about their safety and hold a press conference.
NPR's Giles Snyder. Stocks opened mixed this morning as the Biden administration issued new consumer protection rules for air travelers. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow slipped about 30 points in early trading.
The new rules say airlines must offer travelers a refund when domestic flights are delayed more than 3 hours or international flights more than 6 hours. Airlines also have to disclose baggage fees up front. Boeing stock took off after a rocky quarter for the plane maker produced a smaller-than-expected financial loss. Strong demand for new airplanes helped give a lift to otherwise lackluster durable goods orders last month. Orders for long-lasting manufactured products rose in March for the second month in a row. Stock in Tesla opened higher despite a steep drop in quarterly profits. Investors were cheered by Tesla's plans to introduce a cheaper electric car model in the second half of next year, earlier than had been expected. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
This is NPR News from Washington. President Biden and presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump won their respective primary races in the key battleground state of Pennsylvania yesterday. Carmen Russell Sluchansky with member station WHYY reports.
There were no lines at many voting places here in Philadelphia as turnout was low with less than 18% compared to the usual 20-25%. That supports recent polling, which shows there isn't much enthusiasm in the state for either of the major two-party presidential candidates. Those who did come out said it was just too important. High school senior Laura Mantini voted for the first time in her life.
I would say probably reproductive health rights is probably the most important one to me out of all of those.
Other voters cited the economy, immigration, and threats to democracy as key motivating factors. For NPR News, I'm Carmen Russell-Sluchansky in Philadelphia.
Former New York Representative George Santos says he's ending his independent bid to return to Congress. On X, formerly Twitter, Santos posted that the rise in anti-Semitism is a factor in his decision. He goes on to say the future holds countless possibilities. His campaign reported no fundraising in March. Japan's first moon lander is withstanding months of extreme freezing temperatures and responding to signals from Earth. Temperatures on the moon can fall to minus 274 degrees Fahrenheit. The lander was not expected to survive this long. It reached the lunar surface in January. I'm Kristen Wright, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Monrovia, growing plants for nearly 100 years. Monrovia grows a diverse selection of shrubs, trees, perennials, and more for different climate and landscape needs, from hydrangeas to lavenders. Monrovia.com.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Pennsylvanians cast their ballots on Tuesday in Senate and House contests, as well as for president and local races, including the special election for Pennsylvania's 139th. That's the seat that former state representative Joe Adams resigned from back in February, partway through his term. Joining us now with results from yesterday's primary are Carter Walker, the Pennsylvania reporter for VoteBeat and Spotlight PA, and Stephen Caruso, the Capitol reporter for Spotlight PA. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So I wanted to start out with the 139th. That's the district that I mentioned Joe Adams resigned from in February. There was there were two things going on, the special election to fill out the remainder of the term, and then what would happen in the primary, who would face each other for the full term next. Stephen, can you tell us what happened there in the special election?
Yeah, so Jeff Olsheimer, a local insurance company owner and a township commissioner, beat Democrat Robin Skeeber. She was a former county worker administrator. So, you know, this is a hold for Republicans. I think that was about expected. You know, that area is pretty red this is a special election that puts Republicans back to gives them an extra vote in the closely divided Pennsylvania House. So, you know, this is the chamber separated by one vote. So every vote kind of counts, every vote you can muster.
Yeah, the 139th covers parts of southern Wayne and northern Pike counties. One vote advantage there, but only through November, because in the fun part of this is that even though Olsheimer bested Democrat Robin Skeeber in the special election, they'll face off again in November for the general election.
Yes. This is just for the rest of this term. They'll face each other again, and they will. Olsheimer actually faced a primary to try and get back on the ballot, and actually he didn't win that. Though, to be honest, like, there are times when people have won the special and lost the primary, but, you know, it didn't happen this time.
We'll wait to be seen for what happens in November now. So in the other key Senate, state House and Senate races for the state, you mentioned the slim margin. Is there anything else that's impacting the balance of power in yesterday's results?
No, not at this point. There have been some interesting primary results that we're still kind of wading through. One of the most noteworthy of Navy national importance was State Representative Kevin Boyle from Philadelphia lost his primary. He had suffered from some public mental health issues. There had been an arrest warrant issued for him, and then it was withdrawn due to apparently a procedural error. But either way, he lost his primary pretty definitively in Philadelphia. So he will be leaving the General Assembly come November unless, you know, he manages to launch some independent bid. But he lost to Sean Dougherty, who is backed by House Democratic leadership. So that would say is probably the most noteworthy result. But otherwise, nothing more to report until November.
And let's talk about the presidential race. The outcome pretty much known. However, it is a key swing state. And is there anything to read from the margins of victory? I mean, Donald Trump won on the Republican side, Democratic primary, Joe Biden won. But there were a couple of other people still on the ballot, even though they've dropped out of the race. Does that impact any sort of things you can foretell with what might happen in the general?
I think it's really hard to tell. Obviously, there's a lot of tea reading that goes in any presidential election because, you know, folks want certainty. But, the main thing you could probably point to, Nikki Haley did, I think, surprisingly well in a few places, but Donald Trump still won every county. you know, Pennsylvania is a state where I think there's a very strong establishment party that's kind of skeptical of Trump. I talked to a few voters who even were skeptical of Trump in deep red regions like Lancaster County yesterday. You know, for Biden, obviously there's the uncommitted write-in campaign, but as I'm sure Carter is going to get into, like, trying to count write-ins in Pennsylvania is tricky. Counties don't necessarily have who the write-in was for, and finding a benchmark to figure out if what the write-ins were seeing are actual uncommitted votes for Biden versus, you know, just somebody writing in Mickey Mouse or writing in some other name because they're just frustrated with the general state of play. It's hard to say. You know, I think overall, like, you know, we will know closer to November what the stakes are like and what the state of play is.
Carter, do you want to talk about that a little bit, about the write-in?
Yeah, Stephen's exactly right. I mean, voting uncommitted is not like it is in other states, where that's an actual option you can tick off. Voters have to write that in the blank space on their ballot. And counties kind of handle these differently. Some will record every write-in and post them online for each precinct. Some, like the county I was in yesterday, they won't do that unless the write-ins reach a certain amount. So to know whether this, you know, campaign to get folks to write in Biden as a protest was successful or exactly how many votes it's got, the campaign that put it on is probably going to have to call every county and determine exactly how many uncommitted votes that they got. But I will say that the write-ins were up in a number of counties where this effort was most likely to be successful. I saw some reporting from the Inquirer that there's big increases in just the pure number of write-ins in Philadelphia, Allegheny County, Montgomery, Delaware, you know, the Democratic strongholds, where there would be the voters that would want to push back against Biden. But again, like Stephen said, a lot of those could be Mickey Mouse. They could be Donald Duck, and we'll just have to wait and see exactly how many were uncommitted. But fair to say that there was at least an uptick and probably something the Biden campaign is watching this morning.
You mentioned some of the protest votes or some of the votes against Biden. There's been some folks that are either writing in or uncommitted across the country. In the Pittsburgh area district, there was some indication about how some of the public sentiment on the war in Israel and Gaza is going. Can you talk a little bit about the progressive Democrat that, you know, fended off the challenge and what that means in terms of the shift in public sentiment on the war among Democrats?
Yeah, so, you know, out in Pittsburgh, Summer Lee, a longtime progressive state rep who became a congresswoman in 2022, she won a primary against Bhavini Patel, who was backed by AIPAC and a lot of other interests that are tied in with Israel. I mean, you know, I don't know if that says anything specific about the war in Israel or the war in Gaza. I mean, I think that Summer Lee had, you know, she faced a very bruising primary in 2022 that AIPAC was involved in, winning a 3-4 way race, if I recall correctly. And then this year is one-on-one. But she really managed to get a lot of the establishment behind her. You know, like the candidate she ran against didn't have a lot of support from anyone in Pittsburgh outside of basically just outside groups. And Pittsburgh's a very parochial city. I mean, I think a lot of Pennsylvania is very parochial. So, you know, I don't know if it's really easy to kind of put the national narratives onto some of these Pennsylvania races. I mean, the main thing I would highlight, honestly, that, you know, in Pennsylvania, Democrats winning in November is really incumbent statewide on having good turnout in Philadelphia. And turnout in Philadelphia has historically been going down. So, like, I would almost lump the concerns about, like, uncommitted in with the fact that, like, Philadelphia turnout isn't good. And I think the uncommitted vote here is just another sign of the fact that, like, the local party sometimes doesn't get people out to vote. People don't feel enthused to vote for Democrats in some ways. And you know, write-ins are just another way, like, you know, of people expressing their displeasure with the status quo, whether that's somebody who's going to the polls to cast a really, you know, a vote because they're protesting U.S. aid for Israel, or someone who just, you know, wants new options of people who's, you know, for who don't come from political families or what have you. Like, you know, these are all ways of registering a protest. It could come from a few places. So I think maybe the signal is still Democrats have work to do, but, you know, the exact cause of that signal, it could be a million things.
Yeah.
I think Stephen is bringing up the real main takeaway from yesterday. Turnout was, you know, by back of the envelope calculations, just from the top level race, the president was, it's about in the mid 20s, around 24-25%. And I'm looking back at the 2020 primary, we were up in the 30% range. So turnout was really down. And even just from the election directors and the county commissioners, that you were hearing the sense from them as they were visiting polls that, yeah, you know, it's just the enthusiasm's not there. People are not showing up. So I think that's going to be one of the biggest determining factors when we get to November is just how many people actually show up at the polls.
And, you know, I mean, I guess because at the presidential level, the, as we said, it's sort of a foregone conclusion there. But did you think that there was some more engagement down ballot with some of these other seats, including, you know, there were some races, attorney general, you had races for treasurer, some other the auditor general, some of those other kind of seats within the state?
Carter, if you don't mind me jumping in, I'll just say, like, from a day of walking around Pennsylvania, I was mostly encountering a lot of voters who really weren't engaged, who just kind of showed up because they did. One person told me they almost forgot to vote, but then they ran out. Multiple people told me they were embarrassed to remember. They couldn't even tell me who they voted for like attorney general, for instance. Then, like, you know, a lot of people were saying, I like to be more informed, but it felt like a lot of people who showed up out of obligation, and not saying that's a good or bad thing. I mean, it's particularly good, I'd say, in, you know, living in a democracy, but I don't know. I just don't think there was a lot of enthusiasm. People seemed to really be checked in or checked out while voting. And, you know, I think that just says more about where we are as a country right now than anything about the races. In fact, one of the biggest surprises in Pennsylvania was the win of Erin McClelland, an Allegheny County businesswoman for the state treasurer's office over State Rep Ryan Bizarro, who is endorsed by a state party. Bizarro had a lot of other endorsements. I think there was a general expectation he'd win, but McClelland won. And, you know, I think if I'm still, it's still early, I'm still getting some of my ducks in a row in a reporting wise, but I think the general impression is just, you know, the people who showed up didn't do as much research as you think, so they didn't have time to see all the endorsements that were racked up, and they decided to go for McClelland because they just thought her profile seemed better when they just, you know, maybe took 5 minutes looking into the race.
McClelland faced Republican Stacey Garrity this fall. Let's just run down quickly the Attorney General and Auditor General races. And then, Carter, I want to turn to your reporting that you broke yesterday about mail-in ballot rejections.
Yeah, Stephen, do you want to talk about the results we saw there?
Yeah. You know, so in the Attorney General's race, Eugene DePasquale won. He is a longtime state office holder. He was the Auditor General. He had name recognition, which I think really helped him pull through. And he'll face Dave Sunday for the Attorney General's position, which is open, wide open race. Michelle Henry, the current placeholder, she isn't running for re-election. And then in the Auditor General's race, Malcolm Kenyatta, same thing, another kind of known name, a Philadelphia progressive. He's one of the first Black LGBTQ representative in the General Assembly. He won the nod for Auditor General. He'll face Tim DeFore and in November for that nod. So, you know, we have some pretty interesting row office races that will be coming through, but, you know, we'll have to wait to see how those start to shake out.
All right. If you're just joining us, we are talking to Stephen Caruso of Spotlight PA and Carter Walker of VoteBeat and Spotlight PA about yesterday's Pennsylvania primary results. All 17 members of Pennsylvania's U.S. House delegation, 9 Democrats and 8 Republicans, will be seeking re-election in 2024 in District 8 in our listening area. Matt Cartwright, the incumbent, was uncontested and will face Robert Bresnahan, who was also uncontested in the general. And so, Carter, I wanted to talk to you about some of the reporting you broke yesterday about Pennsylvania's redesigned mail ballot envelopes. They're still tripping up many voters who left dates incomplete. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, you know, dating has always been an issue here in Pennsylvania. We've talked many times about that to your listeners. You know, Pennsylvania law requires that voters handwrite a return date on their mail ballot return envelope. And the problem has been for years that voters are writing their birth date, the date that they registered, dates that haven't happened yet, like in the future, for whatever reason they're making those mistakes. And you know, in an effort to try and cut down on this, the Department of State redesigned the mail ballot envelope to try and make it a little bit more intuitive of how you're supposed to fill it out. And as part of that, they put in the first two digits of the year in the year line. So they put 20, and then they left the last two digits of the year blank. Well, what we saw was a lot of voters ended up not filling in those last two digits of the year. So they would just write 4/17 and let the pre-filled 20 stand. And counties are, again, you know, this is a common theme. They're at a difference of opinion in whether or not they should be counting those. You know, some counties considered it, okay, well, that's That's not an improperly dated ballot, so we're going to count it. Other counties disagreed with that. And, you know, late in the election, on last Friday, the Department of State sent out a opinion to counties that they didn't consider it to be an incorrect date, so they were encouraging counties to count them. But it's unclear right now how many counted them. It's unclear how many ballots that specific mistake is going to account for, but it seems to be a lot. Counties I spoke with were telling me that dating issues in general, where the majority of the ballots that represented the majority of the ballots that were going to be rejected, and that this specific dating problem, not filling in the last two digits of the year, were the majority of those ballots. So new problem that we're facing here with how to date ballots. It's unclear if the Department of State might, you know, change their mind on the design and redesign it so that maybe the full date is filled out. We'll have to wait and see on that, or if they're going to adjust the problem. But again, it's just a reminder that, you know, our laws here are kind of always in flux. We weren't even sure up until a couple of weeks ago whether or not voters were going to have to date the ballot. And, you know, this issue is still tripping them up and causing issues here.
Yeah, I'm looking at the graphic that you have, the photo you have of the Pennsylvania mail ballot for the 2024 primary election on your website, votebeat.org. And you can see the 2-0 filled out in the last two blank. I guess I could understand how that could trip someone up. But even though the Department of State is saying you guys should count these, that doesn't really carry the force of law, right?
Right, yes. The Department of State, you know, the law is the law, and not precisely what the Department of State says, or they hold the position that these dates are not material at all, and voters shouldn't be forced to write them down. But the law says that they have to be written down, and the courts have recently upheld that, so voters do need to include them. I think the debate here right now is whether or not that needs to be a full date, or whether or not that just the two digits that they pre-filled in is enough. You know, the Department of State took the opinion that doesn't constitute an incorrectly dated ballot. I think some counties are disagreeing. You know, one county pointed out to me that there was a court case back in 2022 where the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, they didn't say necessarily that you need all four digits of a year, but when the Supreme Court offered their vision of what a proper date was, the date did include all four digits of the year. So it's, again, one of those open questions about what do we do properly here? How do we count these things? And, again, we have some counties doing one thing, some counties doing another, which means voters in one area are subject to one set of rules and voters in another area aren't.
This subject of writing dates on the ballots, return envelopes, has been a subject of debate and litigation for the last 4 years, right?
Yeah, pretty much nonstop. we had court cases start in 2021, 2022. We had some start last year that are still going on. That last year, in 2023, most recently, like I was alluding to, we had a decision in the U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals that the dating requirement would stand, and so that's why we still had to have voters date the ballot this year. But that's being appealed now. Might go all the way up to the Supreme Court. Who knows what happens there, or if the appeal is even successful. And, you know, I don't think we'll even know if it goes up to the Supreme Court. Maybe that won't even be the end of the road. Maybe we'll see new litigation start up in state court or back in federal on slightly different issues. You know, the issue here, as I've said, is that state court requires it, but voting rights groups and voters have been contesting it because they argue it's not valid. It doesn't have any bearing on anything. And the key point that they point to is that, you know, this date, this handwritten date on the ballot, county election offices aren't actually using it for anything. When counties send out and receive a ballot, they scan a barcode. So they know exactly when they sent that ballot out, and they know exactly when they received it, irrespective of what a voter writes on it. So it doesn't really provide them any value from an administrative or security standpoint.
Yeah, you, in your article, Marion Schneider, Senior Voting Rights Policy Counsel at ACLU of Pennsylvania, you quote saying, if someone wrote 417 and didn't write the year, there's only one year it possibly could have been written because we know when counties mailed the ballots and when the counties received them. So I guess that makes sense, but maybe not to everybody. Do you think the state will be redesigning these envelopes in response to this issue?
I'm not sure yet. I think, they had a lot of bull go, I think, when they redesigned this ballot, of trying to reduce errors. You know, of course, we want everybody to vote who is eligible to vote. I think they're going to wait and see what the data says on how it did this reduce overall errors with the ballots. You know, obviously, it backfired a little by creating this new specific problem, but I think if it overall reduced the error rate, you know, I don't think you could ever perfectly design a ballot or any system, really, that is going to be 100% free of human error. The question is, you know, what percentage of voters can they reduce from making that error? And the jury is still out on that.
Before we go, any other key takeaways from yesterday's primary, Stephen and Carter?
Well, I think it just went very smoothly. We didn't see any major issues like we saw in Luzerne in 2022 or Northampton last year, which I think is making state officials and county election officials really breathe a sigh of relief. You know, we don't want any more unintended attention to how we run our election that can give people looking to sow doubt any more tools.
And I would say on the political end, like looking at state house races overall, there honestly was not a lot of drama. A lot of incumbents held on. A lot of candidates backed by very progressive, very conservative groups haven't seemed to have done super well. So I'm just kind of still looking for results. But so far, it almost seems like it's been a win for the establishment in a few places.
Mm-hmm. More to come. I know we'll be talking to you guys again. Stephen Caruso of Spotlight PA, the Capitol reporter there. Spotlight PA is the independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit newsroom dedicated to high quality investigative and public service journalism about Pennsylvania state government and statewide issues. And Carter Walker with VoteBeat PA and Spotlight PA. VoteBeat is the nonpartisan local reporting on elections and voting. Thank you guys both for joining us, and see you before November.
Thank you so much.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, celebrating 30 years of the Delaware Highlands Conservancy. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York, a newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Thursdays at 9, it's Connect the Dots with me, David Christian. It's the freeform show where each song leads to the next by way of a musical connection. Think of it as a dive into music's liner notes, exploring the behind-the-scenes connections that show that the distance between genres and decades is often shorter than we think. That's Connect the Dots, Thursday nights at 9, here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Listen local.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Delaware Highlands Conservancy is celebrating their 30th anniversary, and they have a special Foods of the Delaware Highlands dinner coming up Saturday, May 4th. Here with more about that and more of their events upcoming, it's Samantha Mango from the Delaware Highlands Conservancy. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good. Happy anniversary.
Thank you. 30 years.
Wow. I mean, 30 years of protecting nature in the area. Again, for folks who may not be familiar with Delaware Highlands Conservancy, what is it you guys do and your mission?
Yeah, our mission is to protect the working farms and forests, the clean waters and wildlife habitat of the Upper Delaware River region.
And you do that by, you know, folks will donate land to you. And what other ways do you do that?
Yeah, they can donate land to us. Mostly we do our work through conservation easements. So if a landowner wants to protect their land, we will place a conservation easement on the property, on the land, and it will be protected in perpetuity. So that means forever. And in the last 30 years, we've protected almost 19,000 acres in upper Delaware River region.
That's amazing. I know you haven't been there for 30 years.
But no, not me personally.
But that sounds like a lot. Has there been an increase in the amount of that land that's getting protected? Or where does that kind of stand? Or do you have a way of gauging that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think it's been consecutive over the last 30 years. And as more interest in protection and the importance of protecting the natural heritage of our area comes to the forefront, people reach out to us and we work with them.
Now, I mentioned the Foods of the Delaware Highlands Dinner, which is coming up May 4. That is the big event for you guys,
yeah,
for the 30th anniversary.
The season.
Tell us more about that.
Yeah, it's on May 4th. It's going to be at Silver Birches in Hawley, Pennsylvania. And we are celebrating our 30th anniversary. And we're going to be having a four-course wine pairing. So it's really elegant. And it's from Chef Ronald O'Rourke at Silver Birches. And we also have a live and silent auction of really interesting, really fun stuff.
Like what?
Lots of fly fishing packages, mm-hmm. Lots of experiences. We're going to have a raffle that you can have buy a chance to win a two-night stay at the spa at the Lodge at Woodlock, which is really lovely.
And where do the funds go for all of this?
It goes to support our mission to protect the working farms, forests, clean water.
You're not taking
wildlife.
A trip to the spa.
No, okay. No. I would love to, but not yet.
All right. Also coming up this weekend, actually, it's the Earth Month Scavenger Hunt.
Yeah.
What's going on with the scavenger hunt? How can folks get involved with that?
Yeah, this is going on until the 27th. This is our Earth Month Scavenger Hunt, and it's any day until the 27th from 1 to 4. You can just go to the Van Scott Nature Reserve that's in Beach Lake, Pennsylvania, and you go to our office and we have a scavenger hunt booklet that you can take and explore our trails. And if you complete it, you bring it back and you get a small prize.
Oh, nice. Gets folks closer to the nature.
Yeah.
I like the advice you give on the website. Please wear closed-toed shoes.
Yes, yes. It is tick season.
Be careful out there. Tree planting at the Van Scott Nature Reserve coming in a couple of weeks.
Yes. Yes, this is on May 11th and May 18th from 10 to 4 at the Van Scott Nature Reserve. We're working with the Wayne County Conservation District and the 10 Million Trees Project. And we're going to be planting, I think it's a total of 850 trees at the reserve. So we definitely need volunteers. If you're interested in helping, please email us or give us a call at the office.
And you partner with the Wayne County Conservation District with the Van Scott Nature Reserve.
Yes.
You know, I've driven by there. I have to say, I haven't been in. What is
why not?
It? I know. I was actually thinking that as I drove by. I'm like, why haven't I been there? What is it that about the reserve is so special? And what does that do for the Conservancy's mission, I guess?
Yeah, yeah. It was gifted to us in 2020 from the Van Scott family. It's 144 acres of various types of land. So we have woodlands, we have meadows, we have wetlands, we have a pond. We do have 3 acres of hiking and walking trails, so it's really beautiful to come out and spend time in nature. We have a brand new pavilion that was built last year up at the top of a hill where you can see New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. So it's a great place to go and spend the day.
And you can just go there. You don't have to go to one of these events we're talking about. The trails are open. There are some, you know, guidelines for visitors, but you could just go and take a day there.
It's free to the public, sunrise to sunset.
This sounds lovely.
It is.
See, I need to go for my own better health.
Exactly.
coming up, we were talking about how folks can donate their land and preserve it. You have conservation conversations with your land protection coordinators about how to do that. Like what is an easement and what do you look for?
That's coming up on May 16th. That's via Zoom. So you don't have to go anywhere. You could just join from your computer. And it's with our land protection team, Trey Talley and Kaylin Hubbard. And you get to learn about what goes into protecting land. If you're interested in having your land be protected through a conservation easement, if you just want to learn more, if you are interested in supporting the Conservancy through donating your land, you can join to learn more because there's various ways that we go about taking on donated land.
And is there a minimum for the amount of land that you look for, or does it vary depending on the area?
It varies. I think our minimum, we try to go for something around 20 acres, but it depends on the type of land that it is.
You know, I'm asking just because there's so many parcels that you see for sale and you wonder, oh, I wonder if someone would donate that as an easement.
We will take real property as a donation, and depending on what type of land it is, we will either put a conservation easement on it or sell it and have the proceeds go to support our mission.
Conservation Conversations, May 16th, if you want to know more about how you can, donate the land, what are the financial benefits for the landowner, how do you go about placing a conservation easement? It's a free event. You're looking for reservations.
Right? Yes. You could just go to our website, DelawareHighlands.org, and you can find it under events.
All right. You have another, you like a scavenger hunt. There's another scavenger.
Oh, we do.
Another scavenger hunt coming up, May 17th. The Finding the Rainbow Scavenger
Hunt. Oh, yes. So it's a scavenger hunt at the reserve, and it's you're going to go off into the reserve and look for items of all the colors of the rainbow.
And then more tree planting, more events coming up. One of the things that caught my eye also was the ramps you pick. It's ramp season, hosted by Delaware Valley Ramps. Now, is this an ongoing event?
Yes, it's every weekend or all Saturdays through, I think it's the 2nd.
Okay. Yeah, it's April through May 19th, it looks like, here on the website. Learn about the plant and management and sustainability, mm-hmm. and you can pick up to 3 pounds of ramps.
That's a lot of ramps.
Per adult. For your own non-commercial use. That's a lot of ramps.
That's a lot of ramps.
But you can do a lot of things with those. That's amazing. That is coming. That's through the 19th. And again, more details at the website, which is DelawareHighlands.org. Pond investigation, May 25th. An in-depth look in the life of a pond.
Yeah, that's at the reserve. We have a pond at the reserve, so we'll be using that for our investigation. It's going to be hands-on, so you're definitely going to get a little muddy and dirty, and we're going to be looking for insects and macro invertebrates.
And anything else you want to mention to folks before we go? You guys are doing such great work, and you know, people love where they live, and you're documenting those testimonials as well on your website.
Yeah, thank you. We do have one more on June 22nd, a paint and sip with Jill Carletti. This is a donation registration event. So registration is $50 per person, and that includes a $25 donation to the Delaware Highlands Conservancy. And it is a paint and sip. So come on out. Paint, sip up at our pavilion out in nature and enjoy it.
Yeah, and I mentioned the love where you live. This is a way of sharing stories, and you can, you know, go on and share your story online as well, including there's something from Katie Lester at Lake Wallenpaupack, who says, I'm reminding of nature's beauty, why I love living in this region of northeast Pennsylvania. Each time my boat passes a bald eagle's nest or a screeching great blue heron, I appreciate the opportunity to recreate in such peaceful waters.
Yeah.
So you can learn why others love where they live or share your story of where you love to live. That's at DelawareHighlands.org. And of course, there's so much more there, including information about their upcoming dinner and all of the 30th anniversary celebration.
Yes, today's the last day to register for the dinner. So
get in there.
Sign up.
Samantha Mango from Delaware Highlands Conservancy.
Thank you
for joining us. We'll take a break. And when we come back, NACL and the special outrage performance for queer writers. We'll have more after this. It's Radio Chatskill.
There's always a story behind the music, how the song was written, why the song was written. I'm Kathy Geary. Join me for Now and Then. Now and Then, Saturday afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll remember Henry Mancini, born 100 years ago and composer of many classic tunes for TV and movies. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Coming up tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll get more from the NACL Quill Writers Workshop in a minute. But first, for more than 8 years, Basil Segos has led the State Department of Environmental Conservation, which is the longest tenure of any New York DEC commissioner. From the New York Public News Network, Chantel Destra caught up with Segos during his last days with the department to unpack his work and legacy.
Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us, Commissioner.
Great to be with you, Chantel. Thanks for coming in.
Now, I wanted to get into your decision to take a step back from the department. I imagine after over 8 years, it was a difficult decision. So what was that decision-making process like?
Yeah, this place is like a second home in a way. I mean, the number of days I've been here since 2015, obviously it's been a long run. I think it was when my staff brought in a plaque last year, noting that I'd been the longest serving commissioner, I started to think, wow, maybe it's a sign, time to move on. It is a great job. I mean, every single day in this job is a privilege. It's an honor to serve the people of New York. And you just know when it's time to go. I mean, there's a reason that commissioners are short timers generally. You know, the career staff are the ones that really run this agency for 20, 30, 40, 50 years in some cases. And the commissioners come along and kind of pull some levers. I think I've done as well as I could to pull those levers over the last 8.5 years. And, you know, it's time to turn the reins over to somebody else. But it's been an amazing run.
And you said that you were going to stay on until the state budget was passed. So I was curious, what type of funding were you hoping to get for the department in the final state budget? And what are your conversations like with the governor and legislative leaders about the department?
Listen, we've had nothing but an amazing run of support from this governor. And this legislature as well. I mean, Governor Hochul has really put her stamp on the environment. You know, everyone talks about the big things, and rightly so, like the Bond Act, which is a huge accomplishment. I often look at the big things as the more mundane issues. How much has our budget increased, our annual budget in this agency? How much has our staffing increased? And under this governor, we are way up on both those things. And that's really important because these are the people and the dollars that we need to spend. Who are carrying out the really important work that the public wants us to do, and we just can't do it without resources. So this governor has been transformative on that front. This budget's a strong one as well. I mean, I know that, you know, there's this extraordinary debate about where dollars should be spent and how much should be allocated to various programs. But ultimately, and I look back now, I have an 8.5-year lens on this. When I started, we were really scraping by. I mean, we had low staffing numbers. We had a very small environment protection fund, $136 million. Now it's $400 million. We had almost zero other capital dollars. Now almost $9.7 billion. So you just look at the change in support that we've gotten over that time from this governor and this legislature. It really is extraordinary. And, you know, I'll leave it to the next commissioner to come in here and find a place that's very well run, that has resources to carry out our mission and is ready for the huge challenges of the future.
And as you mentioned, you have a long resume of environmental work, but was there anything that surprised you when you took on the position of being at the helm of the department?
Oh my God, every day. I mean, I'm surprised even today. You know, I mean, seriously. And I think that's what I brought to the job is just a big open mind and a quest for learning about the agency and its people. You know, if you told me the day I started that we would have become a plumbing company within 2 months, I never would have believed it. But that's exactly what happened. We hit the village of Hoosick Falls. I've talked about that quite a bit recently, which lost all of its water. And it forced us into a very creative posture of having to, how do you address that? And it really brought us 600 DEC staff into a crisis intervention, going house to house, installing plumbing in people's houses. I mean, that was just a huge paradigm shift in my mind about what this agency can do. And we've done, you know, we were active in COVID. We worked, built and managed the drive-through testing facilities, the vaccine sites. We delivered food to people that were homebound and hungry. I mean, we are so creative here. So it's not just the mission and the sort of, you know, the traditional environmental work that we do here. It's there are people in this agency that do incredible stuff that's way beyond their ability. And I think we have a real team approach to things. And so that always surprises me, just the kinds of things we can do. And that's got to make people, I think, feel like this is a good government. It's a well-run agency. Call upon them to do lots of really important work. And it helps restore faith in government. You know, is I think we're at a time right now that people have been tested, their beliefs in institutions, for lots of reasons. So it's really important when you're in these positions to run this place with a sense of integrity. Yeah.
That is New York DEC Commissioner Basil Segos, who's departing the job after a lengthy tenure. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The outrage was born out of a need for a space where queer writers can be in community, write, and share with one another for intentional and honest feedback. Queer writers are often faced with the challenge of explaining queerness before receiving tangible notes, and the outrage is an environment for exploration, providing a safe space for risk-taking and imagination. Playwright and performer Julian Jimenez is the creator and organizer of The Outrage, and he'll be joined by seven other writers working on plays and prose centered around queer narratives on Friday. The artists will share their works, reading excerpts from pages crafted during their residency at NACL. Joining us now is Julian Jimenez and Lindsay Anderson, Director of Experience, Artist Experience at NACL for the theater at Highland Lake. Sorry, had a little brain nudge there.
NACL.
NACL Highland Lake. I had it written down, but I couldn't see it. Good morning.
Thanks for having us, Tim.
How are you?
Thank you.
Julian, did I kind of explain that correctly at the beginning there about what you're trying to do with this residency?
Absolutely. I think there's, you know, there are a lot of writers' residencies out there, but, you know, there are not that many that are focused specifically on queer work. And I was just sort of always hearing these narratives and feedback sessions for it about like, oh, your work is so courageous. It's so powerful. It's like, yeah, that's great. Like, can we move on and find out what's wrong with my play or what's wrong with my narrative or like give me real feedback? And I think that we can skip explaining what queerness is and we can skip the empowering statements because we all understand it as queer writers. So we give each other feedback in a really honest and open way that really elevates our work.
You kind of want to fast forward through that part and get to the writing. I mean, not that the queerness doesn't influence your writing, but you don't want to have to explain the queerness.
Yeah. Absolutely. And in so many of those spaces, people who are giving feedback are like, well, tell us about this. Like, why did you choose to do the time signature this way? So there are things that about queer narratives that are just innate in us because we live different lives. We can't go, you know, in a regular climax Aristotelian structure. So
I apologize. I think I misgendered you in the introduction. So,
I go he, they pronouns. Okay. So it's perfect.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
And
thank you.
You're a playwright. You've been working for a long time. You hold an MFA from the Actors Studio Drama School, many different plays. What led you to want to create this space, not only for yourself, but for others? You're sharing this with others. We talked a little bit about that, but
yeah,
what's the larger kind of goal for you?
I was always an I would say activist or unwilling activist, just when I would see sort of injustice or see things that were not happening, I wanted to make it happen. And I wanted to make sure that we had an affinity space for these writers to do that. And it's always something that I was looking for, and I was never able to find, you know, that would elevate my work in a way that empowers me, that I didn't feel like I had to cookie cutter my work into heteronormative structures. I wanted to make sure that other queer writers had that. And if I can find a way to do it, I'm an educator. I just am a public servant. I'm a, you know, that's what I do. So.
How did you find it to come to NACL? Was it just like a no-brainer? It's like
yeah, and I didn't even know about NACL until I met Brad Krumholtz, right? At the Deepwater Literary Festival where I was performing, and then he was like, "Oh, we should do something. Do you have an idea?" And I was like, "Actually, I do." Yeah.
It came together really effortlessly, and I love watching all of these writers come in and be able to be inspired by the beauty of, you know, the southwestern Catskills and this cold spring that we're having, and they all just seem so wonderful and kind to each other. It's been an incredible week so far.
So the week started on Sunday, Monday?
Monday.
And so you'll go through the rest of this week, and then on Friday, you're presenting this to the public. What are some things that folks can expect? And tell us a little bit about some of the other artists.
Yeah, some of the other, I mean, we have a wide, diverse range of artists and queer writers, and I wanted to try to incorporate as many of the letters of the LGBTQIA+ communities as possible, so that there was a different range of thought. So, you know, we have trans writers, lesbian writers, bisexual writers, pansexual writers. So there's a whole slew of representation. So it's not just one particular letter in the alphabet, which I normally find. And we every night now we're doing sharings with each other to give each other feedback. And you're going to see some really interesting excerpts of stories of how the feedback has influenced them. And yeah, I think it should be a really lovely night. And we're going to read each other's work.
And many times NACL has these works in progress. That's sort of, that's what this is, really. This is like sort of the result of this week and totally. The result of the sharing.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And do you expect that or hope that you could take something out of this and develop it for something else later and workshop
it? Oh, yeah,
it
in absolutely. A different way? I think a lot of the writers, and including myself, are writing. I just started to write something from scratch, and I wrote 40 pages yesterday, which is wild. and then, you know, other people are working on projects. So they're using this as development so that hopefully it can get a production somewhere else. Some people are not only writing in plays. Some people are writing prose, memoir, and poetry. So, yeah.
There's a range. We're not just talking about theater or stand-up, you know, proscenium. There's a variety of...
Yeah, I would say all the writers are playwrights, but some of them have chosen to work on different projects in writing, and that's totally up to them as far as, like, poetry. Someone's writing a poetry chapbook. Someone is... I'm writing a memoir as well as a play. So, yeah, there's a lot of different things. I wanted to open that up so that we didn't feel confined in the medium.
You're just doing. You're just a memoir and a play. You know.
Yeah.
Just a couple things I'm working on. little things. It's only Wednesday morning. You started on Monday.
Yeah.
What's been one of the kind of key takeaways for you so far?
I would say the fellowship with the other writers is so important. And like the very first day, basically none of us wrote anything. We just got to know each other. We just got to talk. And that really influenced the work that I was doing the next day. And that's how I was able to churn out 40 messy pages. But I was able to do that because I was so inspired by the conversations we were having about, we were talking about queerness. It's a space where there are things that and topics that we can discuss and how queerness influences that in a space. I've never been around so many people like that and just in one space in order to discuss how it affects us as queer people.
Was that because there's no pretense of anyone else in the room? And there,
Feels it's open. There aren't other people around where we have to like censor ourselves or feel like we might be judged. So we are in a safe space where we can openly talk about and discuss things and in harsh ways. And what's been really great is we've been talking with each other and everyone just has respect and we're challenging each other, but with such grace and respect, it's really kind of amazing.
Yeah. Is that reaction from being the organizer of the event or from a participant in the event or both?
I would say I feel more like a participant. I organized everything basically with NACL until this moment. And now I feel like I'm not an organizer. I feel like I'm just a participant, which is lovely.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the other artists that are there. I've been looking on the website here. David Anzuelo.
Yes.
And can you tell me a little bit about his work?
David Anzuelo is an actor that I've worked with for a very long time, and he's a prominent fight choreographer on Broadway and off Broadway with Uncle Dave's Fight House. And he really has started his playwriting journey like a few years back and wanting to tell stories of his life and his queer Chicano experience. So, yeah, he's really amazing.
Some of the other artists include Mona Mansour.
Mona Mansour, yes. Mona is an amazing writer, is an award-winning writer, had the Vagrant Trilogy at the Public Theater a few years back. And she really writes about, you know, Muslim identity. And, yeah, she's just wonderful. Mm-hmm.
Laura Thoma.
Laura Thoma, yeah.
Thoma.
Yeah,
I'm Laura Thoma. Pronouncing Thomas. Everybody's name.
Yeah, yeah, no. It's, Laura's great. She lives in Connecticut, and she does a lot of regional work, and she was a dancer originally and then transitioned to be a writer after an injury, and she is just fantastic, and she's writing a crazy comedy. Yeah.
And then also we're talking about the trans writer performer that's Flower Estefano Rios.
Yes, Flower is a pretty much a new writer. That was really important for me in this is to have sort of mid-level emerging writers and then also like, you know, further career ready writers all together, so we're learning from each other. And Flower did a lot of cabaret and performances and a lot of she's a singer, and she's starting to write stories about her trans experience. So I wanted to give her this platform.
I don't want to mess up this name. Mashouk Mushtaqdeen?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. he did it.
I would be a recipient of the Lambda Literary Award for Drama.
Yes.
I just wanted to highlight that.
Yeah, Dean is an amazing writer, has this play called Draw the Circle, and was a one-person performer about his life growing up and transitioning. And he's just... Dean is probably one of my biggest influences.
Well, I'm just looking at his bio, and then he's a queer transgender man and the child of Muslim Indian immigrants.
Yes.
There's so many layers of the story, and yep. I imagine that many of that's coming out on the page or in this workshop.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
And this is the first time you've done something like this?
First time I've done something like this as an organizer.
As an organizer, yeah.
Yeah, I was also, you know, I've been wanting to do this for about 10 years, and then also... Sean Abley created the Desert Playwrights Retreat, and I was invited to that, and that was in Palm Springs, and it's that's a queer writer's residency as well. And I was like, oh, I got so inspired by him as well, and so I wanted to sort of do that on the East Coast.
Yeah. Do you think this might become something regular?
I'm hoping so. Like, I'm trying to see if I can partner with a theater company that might. Yeah. Help subsidize.
We know
bit.
One.
Yeah. Well, they already are. Like, I want to partner with. So have, see, yeah. Yeah. So yeah. I want to. NACL has just been incredibly generous to me, and to our community, and that's really so empowering. Mm.
Was it? How was it interacting, folks, to participate in this workshop in this residency?
Oh.
People sign right up.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like, I made the offer, and it was like, yes, yes. I think only...
They're looking for the same thing you are, the space.
Exactly. And I think there was only one writer that wasn't able to do it, but wanted to, but they had another commitment. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they were like, absolutely sign me up. Where is it? I need to go. And it's important that I made it entirely free so that it was accessible for queer people, as you know, so that... Because we know many times queer people are you know, it's harder to find jobs. And I just wanted to make access. So they're completely free. They're getting $100 travel stipend as well. Yeah.
Lindsay, talk a little bit about what folks can expect on Friday and again, how they can get more information.
Yes. So show starts at 7:30 on Friday. We're going to have a lovely pot of soup afterwards. So we're all going to be able to discuss what we saw. Over the table together. So that's a beautiful part of our culture and something that everybody that comes can look forward to.
You guys always have the soup, which is great.
The soup, it's important.
I know. Part of the ritual of NACL.
Yeah.
Again, more information about this and all the other events at nacl.org. Ticket information there, Friday, April 26th from 7:30 to 9:30 at NACL in Highland Lake. Just before we go, you know, briefly, if you can talk about like the importance of having this residency as part of the panorama of everything that you do at NACL.
Yeah, its importance is very significant. I think we want to feel like this is a safe haven for people to come and to express themselves.
All artists,
absolutely. And to provide that for people is one of the great privileges of my life, actually. So I just want more and more, and I'm very lucky, and I know that everybody that will come and see this work will feel lucky themselves.
Julian Jimenez is the creator, organizer of The Outrage, and Lindsay Anderson is the director of artistic experience at NACL. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. We'll take that's it. We're not taking a break. We're going to go. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can hear this episode and other episodes, as well as all of our local programming at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruto. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include the Sterling Business and Technology Park, located at Exit 17 on Interstate 84 in Northeast Pennsylvania, offering opportunities to locate or expand businesses on property zoned for manufacturing and other uses. More information at sterlingbusinesspark.com. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org. Thank you.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello.
Radio Catskill.
On air, online, on your smartphone, and on your smart speaker.
Public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. We are Radio Catskill, keeping you connected.